Welcome to First Fuel, a podcast bringing you perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management and demand response in the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by Associate Professor Wendy Miller from QUT. Wendy, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hi Luke, thanks for having me.
Wendy, I'm delighted to have you with us to discuss the burgeoning research agenda around energy efficiency, energy management, renewable energy, and especially how they interact. You're the right person to be talking to because we have a keen interest in this agenda at the Energy Efficiency Council, and your name keeps coming up. But before we dive into the detail of what you've been working on, I want to start by exploring the philosophy that you bring to your research. We spend a lot of time here on First Fuel talking about how the silos between different policy areas and different technology streams, like the demand side and the supply side of the energy system, they're really crumbling, and we need to start thinking about these issues in a profoundly integrated way. And when I looked across all the different areas of research that you're engaged in, it seemed like you were very aligned with that view, and you've said that it's essential we take a systems approach to solving some of these tricky issues that are arising as we work our way through this energy transition. So I wonder if you just talk to me a little bit about the philosophy you bring to your work.
I think it actually relates not so much to my philosophy, but my background. My university training is in classical music.
Okay.
I'm not an engineer. I'm not an architect. I've been involved in music since I was about five through school, and my undergraduate degree was in music, in performance, and in education, and so was my master's degree. And music combines math, science, particularly physics, but art, culture, physiology, how to manage people, and it's very performance outcomes based. So it's a very socio-technical skill. So that's always been what I've been involved in. So when I got into energy and engineering and buildings type things, those natural training, I guess, that I've practiced all my life became part of that.
Yeah.
The second is, I guess I'm fairly strongly influenced by some writings by Rocky Mountain Institute and Amory Lawrence.
Yep.
So factor four and then factor 10, and how he explains from an engineering perspective, I guess, the importance of whole systems thinking, integrative design, which fits in really well with my background as well. And probably the third thing is our personal family interest in sustainability and how the understanding of what sustainability is has evolved over time. So for a long time it was presented as three legs of a stool, for example, trying to sort of balance the ecological or the environmental, social and economic things. But a better understanding of sustainability is the nested approach, where the system is the planet that we live on. That's the boundaries, that's the system. Within that system, people live. So that's the nest within the system. And within that people system are the technologies and the economies that we choose to use to enable us to live within the planetary system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a trade-off between economics, environment and people. The economics and the technology have to fit with the people who have to live within the context of our planetary system. So that's my philosophical approach, all wrapped up together, is the socio-technical have to work together within the bounds of the planetary system. And I've only been involved as a formal researcher, I guess, fairly recently as my second or third career. So the understanding the context and what is the system that we're talking about, what are all the components of the system, how does culture, history and technology and environment all have to be addressed in answering whatever question it is that we're addressing.
There's so much that you've just said that I would love to unpack. It's incredible. I suppose to start with your first point around, your background as a musician, there's all that theory underpinning it, as you say, right? There's so much history and culture and mathematics and everything that comes to a head at the moment of performance.
Yes.
Like
yes.
it's all fantastic and it's all absolutely crucial, but it ultimately comes down to what actually happens on the stage in front of that audience. And there's certainly an analogy there for, you know, the all the different parts of the system that we're trying to make perform as well as they can as we move through this transition, right?
Yes. And as a musician, my particular interest was and my experience has been in conducting or leading or concert bands or choirs. So I often say to my research team that I see myself as a conductor of all the players in the energy efficiency and buildings and renewable energy field. I'm not the expert in any of those particular things, but I like to try to bring them all together so that the outcome, which is the performance of a choir or band to the audience, pleases the audience to meet their expectations. So it's very outcomes based.
Yep.
It's the process has to deliver what it is that you want it to deliver.
And to extend the analogy, we'll see how far we can take this, Wendy. There's a sense in which all of those different members of the orchestra, if we can put it like that, you know, the buildings and the appliances and the energy system and, you know, the sources of energy, the generators, they've all been allowed for a very long time to operate in silos. They could just do their thing, and it was certainly the available to policymakers to think about them as discrete areas that could be regulated on their own. And of course, you know, that's being blown up around us, and we're needing to think about how all these different parts of the system work together to deliver an optimal outcome, right?
Yeah, but it's not just working together either. As with an orchestra, it's a mutual respect for each expertise. And it's a mutual acknowledgement that to achieve an outcome, which is a good performance outcome, sometimes different people within that system take the lead, and at other times they blend into the background and they become the supportive structure of what the lead melody or something is at a time. So the mutual respect and the not competing for being the shining star or the most important thing, I think, is really important in this systems approach. And whether that's architects or engineers, whether it's building services engineers or network engineers or policymakers or consumers, prosumers, we all need to work together to deliver an outcome, and we're all important. We don't all have to have the loudest voice at any one point in time, but all voices need to be heard.
Yeah, absolutely crucial at different points in the process. And you could extend that analogy as well to the different technologies we're bringing to bear on the transition.
Yes. So that's, I guess, the philosophy behind my interest then as a researcher in energy, particularly at a building level. It astounds me that in the transition, say, for Australia's electricity network to a modern or net zero carbon potential or whatever, that we generally don't include buildings in that equation. We think in terms of the efficiency of appliances, maybe renewable energy, how it integrates, etc. But without considering buildings and the purpose of buildings, which is for people, in that whole equation. So how can we come up with a good solution if we're not considering the key part of it?
Well, you've hit on one of my hobby horses, Wendy, because I'm on a Unity ticket with you there. If we sort of think about the energy system transition as something that's occurring, you know, in isolation to the way that we utilise energy, whether it's in buildings or in manufacturers or in any other part of the economy, you know, it's going to be more expensive. It's going to be a lot more difficult to deliver an optimal outcome for the people that are using energy, and it's going to mean that the transition takes that much longer as well.
Yeah. So as a family, we made a decision to try to get to net zero energy back in about 1996, around about, as a family of two adults, three school-aged children. So a lot of my research subsequently has also been looking at if we as a family who were fairly informed about climate change, about efficiency, about renewable energy options, etc. And we had trouble navigating how do we what technologies do we choose, how can we improve our house, and all of those sorts of things. How much more difficult it is for the general population to follow things if we who are immersed in that field had trouble. And that's why I'm strongly focused on the socio and also regulatory barriers to transitions as well as the technical things.
Well, it's interesting. That's where my mind was going as well. So interested in what your reaction is to the kind of the regulatory regime that exists here in Australia now when it comes to building energy performance and kind of where you think it needs to go.
Well, interestingly, about for the last 10 years, I guess, we've been trying to talk the energy retailers in Queensland, for example, to take account of the energy efficiency of housing in housing estates when they design the electricity infrastructure for new housing estates. But they don't seem to realise if you have 4-star houses compared to 8-star houses, what that means in terms of air conditioning, energy and demand. And we've tried to do modelling to show, you know, I don't understand why the electricity industry, why the networks don't get behind pushes to try to get the Australian Building Codes Board to increase the minimum performance requirements for the thermal efficiency of housing in particular. They don't seem to understand the impact of the thermal efficiency of the building envelope on air conditioning demand, even though we know that air conditioning demand is the thing that's driving prices, congestion, heatwave blackouts, et cetera. And I don't understand why everybody can't get it, that unless we address the thermal efficiency of the building envelope, it doesn't matter if all your air conditioners are, you know, minimum performance performance standards or not. We still need to address the efficiency of the building envelope. And that's sort of one of the things that's sort of a focus of the International Energy Agency Annex that I'm involved in.
It's almost that, going back to your analogy earlier, it's like the nesting doll of efficiency, right? And the fundamental unit in the middle of that Russian nesting doll is the home. And that home is an integrated system, and they're multiplied by millions across the landscape. But if that fundamental unit isn't working properly, problems will abound. Wendy.
Yes. So we're starting to try to address some of that, well, get more evidence to try to change the mindset of the policymakers, both through the RACE 2030 CRC, the International Energy Agency, to try to change those mindsets to make building energy efficiency, in particular homes, a part of the system transformation that needs to happen in Australia.
Well, you've provided me with a wonderful segue into one of the first topics that I wanted to cover off, which is indeed your work with the International Energy Agency's Energy in Buildings and Communities program, and particularly Annex 80, which is focused on resilient cooling, which is starting to look in a very focused way on, you know, some of the changes that are being driven by climate change, some of the extreme weather events, and the imperative really to ensure that we're designing buildings that are able to withstand those shifts and keep occupants comfortable, but also importantly healthy. Wendy, do you want to just explain that work to me?
Yeah, so Annex 80 was started about the middle of 2019, so I'm Australia's rep on that international group, and at the moment there's probably about 25 countries participating through at least 30 different research organisations. And the focus is looking at resilient cooling of buildings and what does that mean. And as a systems thinker, the task that I led for that annex was, what does resilient cooling mean? What's the framework that we have to think about? I'm one of the few socio-technical researchers in this international group. Most of them are building scientists or engineers who wanted to jump straight into what are the key performance indicators for cooling technologies, what technologies, how efficient are they, et cetera. But I managed to convince them that we need to consider what does resilience mean for different players in the system. Who are all the stakeholders? What is the system? So about a month ago, we had published in an academic journal our socio-technical approach to resilient cooling. So that looks at what does resilience to overheating mean to humans, to their physiology and to the cultural context in which people live. What does it mean for equipment? What does it mean for buildings? And what does it mean for the energy network? And if you even so for about a year, I was immersed in literature from all of those different segments, how different the different silos even define what resilience is. And, you know, from an engineering perspective, it might be reliability or redundancy. But resilience from a medical professional's point of view means something else. Resilience from a social point of view means something else. So bringing all those things together into saying, if we're going to have systems that we can rely on to cool buildings, to keep people healthy, we need to consider the people, the buildings, the technology that's providing the cooling, and the reliance of that technology on its own energy or on the network, on the grid. And so as part of that work, then the group has been working in three main streams. One is what key performance indicators do we need? So we've just been discussing a range of key performance indicators that we might recommend to each country. So, for example, from a building thermal efficiency point of view, in Australia we have a star rating for buildings, sort of indicates how much annual energy, or now it's how much seasonal energy we need for heating or cooling. But emerging key performance indicators might be passive survivability. So, for example, if your power supply was cut, how long can you survive in your building without getting too hot or too cold and it become a health problem for you? So that type of thing. The group's also been looking at the weather data. So in Australia, all of our building energy efficiency is based on typical meteorological years for a 20-year historical weather data. So it's an average of averages over a 20-year period, and how will the building perform under that? But if we think of the nested approach to sustainability, we don't live in an average world. We live in a world where we as humans and our buildings and our technology experience the minimums and the maximums of temperature and of solar radiation or of rainfall, etc. So our models or our processes for assessing how good a technology or a building is needs to account for not just the mean, but the actual, so doing a histogram or a frequency map of, you know, how long is a temperature going to be at particular particular highs or lows, for example. So that's been evidenced this year across the world. So now, for example, in Canada and Northwest USA, where they're experiencing really extreme hot weather that whole infrastructure is not catered for, whether it's buildings, people, no air conditioning systems, etc. But it was the same in Texas earlier this year, in January this year, when they had really, really extreme cold temperatures, and their gas power stations didn't work, so then they had no heating in their houses, their water supply pipes all burst, etc. So there was, because we design things based on averages or probability of extreme events, not happening very frequently. We don't design our infrastructure and systems to account for that.
Mindy, I think this is an absolutely crucial, and it's a real sleeping giant. Like, I have a strong feeling that this could really blow up in the next few years as, you know, as people get their head around the fact that we are going to be dealing with these extremes more regularly and they see their infrastructure crumbling around them. So the easy bit is implementing this in new buildings, you know.
Yes.
That's something where, you know, we've got really well-established processes for, you know, upgrading building codes for new buildings and the like. And while, you know, not everybody might think it's the highest priority, we've at least got a pathway. The challenge is how to deal with all of our existing infrastructure and at a fair clip, right? Because we're not talking about, you know, threats to infrastructure that are sort of 20 or 30 or 40 years down the track. They're happening, as you say, right now in 2021.
And part of that, you mentioned that we have processes, but some of the processes we have for dealing with change or identifying what our risks are actually to start with. So, interestingly, I was asked at the beginning of last year to teach a risk management unit at university for engineers and in the construction industry. And there's a term in risk management that talks about black swan events, and a lot of engineers would be familiar with that. And that term was derived, I can't remember whether it was 1700s or 1800s in Europe, to describe an event that's so rare to be improbable and unlikely, because in Europe, all the swans are white and no one had seen a black swan before. You come to Australia and we have flocks of black swans. So if you think about the analogy then for events, so Australia is experiencing flocks of black swan events, which from an engineering and a risk management process in the past have been thought of as improbable, or in data analysis we tend to ignore the outliers of data because surely that data must be a mistake. Reality. So our processes of understanding and analysing data and understanding risk has tended to ignore the unlikely or the things that are considered black swan events, but they're becoming regular. And even if they were not everyday events but every 40 years or 20 years, a building is meant to provide, you know, life for 50 or 60 years, maybe. I think Australian government expects 50 years in their policies. So what are you going to do when a black swan event happens? What, how are you going to live in your house? And that issue sort of came up with the events in Melbourne, in Victoria recently with...
up in the Dandenongs, Wendy, and as you say, there was you know, severe storm activity and, you know, relatively flimsy power connections into many of those buildings in what is a very beautiful part of Melbourne. And all of a sudden, in the middle of winter, many, many households found themselves plunged into darkness. They didn't have any power. They were living, as you say, in homes which weren't designed to be warm and comfortable in the absence of that power supply. And it was, you know, very significant health impacts as well as obviously, you know, incredibly inconvenient for those families involved.
Yes.
Now the Victorian government rallied around and has been providing a huge amount of support to those families, but that's just one small area, and it's a bit of a taster for what's to come if we don't start to grapple in a very focused way with some of these issues, right?
Yes, but there was also an interesting article in the ABC in the last couple of days about three households in that region that had PVs and batteries, and one was off-grid and one had, you know, a particular type of battery, one a Tesla Powerwall type thing. So even their experiences highlighted to me that we know that Australians, householders are taking up PVs and are starting to take up batteries, et cetera. But unless even the householders understand our level of resilience and what these technologies do and don't do, and take some of those, ask themselves some questions about what am I trying to achieve? What does this technology do to me? How would this technology help my family? under normal circumstances and under a circumstance should the power go down for any reason or whatever. So there's still, I think, a fairly low level of knowledge both in community but also for renewable energy installers, et cetera, in advising people on what does a PV system do to you, for you? What does a battery system do for you? What are the pros and cons of connected to the grid or not connected to the grid? How can you set up a system where you can prioritise what are your essential circuits in the event of an event such as at Dandenong, so that instead of running, all your household, what are your key things you want to be able to run? So as a family, we've been experimenting with those things for the last decade as well, and sort of have set up our house so that should the grid go down, A, we have a system that the PVs can still supply energy into a battery system, and we've prioritised communication as being the one thing that we don't want to lose. We've put our ceiling fans, because we live in subtropical Australia, put our ceiling fans as a comfort mechanism that we don't want to lose. So we have that on a DC circuit, and we can switch on some lights and run a refrigerator for a time. So being able to do our water pump is our other thing because we run off rainwater. So being able to have water supply and communication, some means of thermal comfort and some means of lighting in the event that we're not connected to the grid.
So what I'm hearing, Wendy, is all we have to do is ensure every household in Australia has an associate professor specialising in energy within the household in order to effectively manage this resilience issue.
No, what I think is I'd like to see our building regulations be able to clearly communicate that when you buy a house, you are told and you are required, and the seller or the designer should provide to you the documentation that shows this is how this house will perform thermally, and if you don't, this is how much you would expect to have to use your air conditioner or whatever your heating and cooling is. This is how long this house will likely to provide you with protection should that energy not be available, and to require every home to have some level of autonomy or essential services for a period of time. Now, whether that period of time is 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, might depend on where you are in the grid and in the different climate zones. But I think we've become too reliant on expecting that the grid will always be there, that it will always provide unlimited power, and that's not the reality.
Well, we do have the opportunity as we work through this transition to build in a new level of resilience, right?
Yes.
Now, whether it's probably not the case that you necessarily want all of those units, if I can call them that, those households kind of being 100% self-sufficient 100% of the time, that would be a very inefficient way of managing this transition. But as we work through it, we have the opportunity, if we provide those guardrails and set clear expectations, we can raise the resilience of the entire network for brief periods, as you say, and we can decide how long is appropriate in different regions and different circumstances for them to disconnect and to be okay, and for the occupants to remain healthy and comfortable. But that's not something that's going to be achieved by itself. That's something that will require some careful thinking and some clear guidance in terms of regulation and a whole bunch of different stakeholders on board to support the market through that process.
Yes, and that, as you say, that might not be at an individual building level. It might be at a community level, that it might be, you know, within neighbourhoods of five or six houses or something, that there's always a communications channel, that there's some means of refrigeration, keeping food, that there's some means of cooking, that there's some means of protecting the thermal requirements for people. So it doesn't necessarily have to be at an individual building level.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments, and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses, and an affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
I feel like there's a very neat segue into the work you've been doing with the Race for 2030. Race standing, of course, for reliable, affordable, clean energy. This big new CRC, which has been out in the market, I think, for just over a year now, and has been busily working through a whole bunch of what are termed opportunity assessments, which are designed to bring a whole bunch of different stakeholders around the CRC together to do some rapid thinking around what the research agenda should be for that cooperative research centre for the next decade. You've been involved with two, Wendy, electrification and renewables to displace fossil fuel process heating, and then residential solar pre-cooling. Would you like to talk a little bit about some of the key themes that are emerging from that work? And I guess that's a way of us thinking through what some of the big research topics might be in the coming years.
So for the solar pre-cooling, so for houses, the idea or the assumption by the energy network, I think, is that can we avoid the problems of peak demand caused by air conditioners, for example, by cooling homes in the middle of the day or early afternoon when there is in some places an excess of solar energy? Can we pre-cool the houses and that cool will stay with home for when the people get home from work or from school, etc., and avoid the need for them to have to turn on their air conditioning at the peak demand time? So that opportunity, the report from that opportunity assessment is currently being finalised and will be sort of presented to the CRC in the next few days, I think. The potential benefits of shifting when the air conditioning happens really depends on a number of things. It depends on the quality of the home. Will it actually hold the cool for long enough to as well? And are the homes occupied or not occupied at the time that it matches the solar energy generation to make it worthwhile? Because you don't want to try to pre-cool a home that has occupants in it and take it below what the thermal comfort or the healthy range for people are. So my personal view is I think that the energy networks are assuming there's more benefit than what will actually exist in practice. So apart from those physical constraints, there's also the cultural constraints of if it's shown that homes can hold that cool for the period to use up the solar energy, will households want that to happen? And that will depend not so much on technology. I think there's technology that will enable that to happen, but who will you trust in to be able to implement that program? And at the moment, I think Australians have a very low level of trust in the energy network. So some potential solutions might be to have aggregators or a third party or social enterprise organisations who can band together households who are willing to participate, and where the benefit then can go back to community, or householders themselves can elect to do it and control it themselves and not give away their or perceived give away their control of their air conditioners. So I think from a research perspective, we need to look at what's the potential in terms of the homes, what are the needs of people, what are the financial incentives or social benefit incentives that can be offered to encourage households that have suitable homes to participate, and how does all of that relate to particular areas of the network, and does it overlap with where there is solar and excess solar in the day that they want to do something with. That's a really big jigsaw puzzle that hasn't all been put together.
It is a massive jigsaw puzzle, and I think there's a few things there. There's the crucial element of all this is how location specific a lot of this is, and the relative value of some of these assets on the network will go up and down wildly depending on where they're situated, right? And then the other overlay, which is so important and which has been a bit of a theme on recent episodes, we had Lauren Solomon, who's the CEO of CPRC here in Victoria, who is an advocate for consumers, talking about the trust deficit and and how that's going to be a real challenge for unlocking some of this value, but if it's done in an appropriate way, value that consumers can share in. But the energy sector is starting from such a low base. Yes. And if anything, the impulse of consumers is to give them the two-fingered salute and tell them to get stuffed. I'm taking care of it myself, thank you very much, and as if I'm going to give you control of anything in my house, right?
But on the other hand, I think Australians generally want to address climate change and want to address energy prices, etc. So I can conceive a future where social enterprises or community organisations might be the party that householders are happy to give permission to do that trading on their behalf rather than directly with an energy company. But we have to stop thinking of one party having control over another and dictating what they need to do, and have a much more collaborative approach. And in my personal view, that requires the energy network, so retailers and distributors, to stop thinking about us as consumers, as passive takers of the products that they choose to offer, and rather where the end user or end producer of energy is the controller and collaborates with a range of people to make the whole system work for everybody.
It's a complete about face in terms of the way that we've thought about that relationship in the past, the kind of the power dynamics, to use power in a different sense of the 20th century energy system is now completely turned on its head. And so the quicker, you know, those players that have been used to thinking about the energy system at a very high helicopter level start to think about it at the granular level, the way it's experienced and the way that value is created at that, you know, in a particular home, in a particular street in southeast Queensland, and what that means and how that can be unlocked, and how, as you say, Wendy, those companies can collaborate with that householder, then we'll be in business, right?
Yes, and typically the energy networks haven't looked at and haven't actively managed what happens below the substation level. Everything's sort of been higher than that. But the issue of is there too much solar or is there too much load is a below the substation, it's in the low voltage sort of network area. So unless we start looking at it from a feeder level, from the network's perspective and from an individual household up level, to me, when the network says there's too much PV without sort of saying, but it's in this area or this area at this time for this long, it's a meaningless thing. It's just as meaningless as saying the average temperature in Brisbane in the year is 22 degrees. It's meaningless and doesn't reflect the reality or enough to make decisions.
Well, Wendy, unfortunately, we're out of time. We've only sort of skated along the surface of the various areas that you're involved with. We haven't even got into the work that you do with ERA and iHub, which is really fascinating as well. We've only briefly touched on race and indeed on your work with the IAEBC. But I think what our listeners can take out of this conversation is just how crucial the research agenda that you're spearheading is. There are a whole range of incredibly complex questions that will not be resolved by sort of, you know, a simple engineering lens, right? Or a very narrow policy lens. We've got to be thinking about, you know, building regulation and energy system regulation and, you know, the availability of technology. All these different elements need to come together in an integrated way, and they need to do so rapidly. And, you know, we at the Energy Efficiency Council are incredibly impressed with your work, sort of, you know, taking a very grounded, outcomes-oriented approach to resolving some of those questions. So more power to you, Wendy, and I'm glad you're out there conducting the various players in this transition.
And I'm only one of many, and I hope to get to a point where my orchestra can operate well without me.
Indeed. So thank you. Thank you, Wendy. Look, that wraps up this episode of First Fuel. If you have comments, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is at Luke Menzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management and demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council at eCouncil. If Twitter is not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au. And if you have questions or comments to Wendy, please feel free to email something through that email address, and we'll pass it on. Make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. And to learn more about the show, including upcoming live recordings, visit eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon.